Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome back to the Impatient with Desire online book club. I hope you noticed that I refer to it as the online book club and not the pre-publication book club, because today is a very special day. It's the actual official pub date of the paperback edition of Impatient with Desire, the Lost Journal of Tamsin Donner, available at bookseller locations and outlets nationwide. You can now order your copy on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, or walk into your local bookstore and pick a copy up, published through Voice Hyperion. And as always, we're here with our author, Gabrielle Burton, and her guest sidekick. Maybe I should call her the daughter, Gabrielle Burton. How are you all this morning?
Good. Good, Tyson. We actually call her Shotgun. She rides Shotgun.
Shotgun.
Yes.
There you go.
Well, congratulations, Mom, on the book day, by the way.
Thank you. It's very exciting. You know, it seems like these days will never come, and then, boom, they're all of a sudden there, and it's very exciting, and the book looks beautiful.
Well, and yes, it does. And you know, Gabrielle, you're an accomplished author. You've had a number of pub dates. How does today compare or differ from all the pub dates in the past?
Well, I would say that finally completing writing about Tamsin Donner, which is something that I started over 35 years ago and worked on off and on, and would go away and then come back to it, and finally bringing that to I'll say some kind of closure on my part, because I wrote the book, but I hope it's not a closure on both learning about Tamsin Donner. It's very exciting. It's very fulfilling. I also feel relieved, because there were many, many, many years that I didn't think I would ever be able to do it. And now it's there. And someone said to me, asked me a question with the hardback, are you feeling sad now that you have put Tamsin to rest? And I said, no, I'm feeling very happy, because I don't feel that I'm putting her to rest. I feel that I'm bringing her back to life, giving her a new life again. So I feel good, Tyson.
Good.
The short answer.
Good. And you know, I mean, there are lots of books that come out in different forms these days, especially with e-books and trade paperback originals. And you know, I guess less and less authors are getting the opportunity to essentially release a book twice, meaning first in hardcover and then a year later in paperback. And then, you know, there are a lot of authors that they don't even really pay attention to the paperback release, which you're obviously putting a major emphasis on this for a number of reasons that we've discussed in the book club broadcasts and online, which is that a subtitle was added, a new cover was added, and what do you think is really the most important part about releasing this in paperback and being out there promoting it?
It just becomes more affordable and more widely available. Hardback books, which most everybody loves, are quite costly, and everybody can't afford them. So the paperback is much more affordable. That's, you know, and also you can kind of tuck a paperback into your pocket and just carry it along on the bus and read it. And there's a lot of things that are very appealing about a paperback. Book clubs generally tend not to buy hardbacks because of economic reasons, and we're all very hopeful that this is a wonderful book club book, and that the book clubs will find it.
That's great. Well, we hope so too.
It's a good read too, don't you think, Tyson?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The format, we've talked about that before. It lends itself very much to a compulsive read, where You're like, well, I'll just read one more section. You know, and next thing you know, it, you're 20 pages further than you thought you were going to go.
Yeah, exactly.
But one of the things that I wanted to bring up today, just to stay on some of the topical interest of what's going on, you know, we've talked a lot about survival and I guess moved into the disaster realm. Can either of you talk about or discuss any of the hurricane earthquake issues that are going on today in the world?
Well, I think, like everybody, that we're just all heartsick about what is happening in Japan, and it just keeps unfolding in terrifying ways. And that is certainly, I mean, you take Japan, which was a hugely rich, materialistic consumer nation, and suddenly a vast part of that country is just, they have nothing. I mean, if they have their lives, so many people lost their lives, but those who have survived so far will have tremendous adversity rebuilding their lives. And I was thinking about, we were talking the other day about a communal spirit versus an individual experience spirit. And on the Oregon Trail, that came to play a lot, where you had this strong, independent, rugged individual spirit that propelled people, and yet when the crunch came, those who survived were the ones who fell back on the communal spirit and helped each other, or at least their family. Japan has always had their strong communal spirit, much more than, you know, we emphasize individuality from the time our children are born. We're one of the few nations that put our babies into a separate room to sleep, and people in America ride their motorcycles without helmets because they have a right to crack open their brains. And we emphasize individuality sometimes to a crazy extent. And in Japan, always the community has been emphasized. And you see people here, like those 70 workers who have stayed at that nuclear plant trying to somehow shut it down and minimize the danger. Those people are basically giving their lives so that other people can survive. And we don't see them running off saying, I'm not going to do this. I mean, they are just doing it.
And they also, I just read an article this morning about the people who had warned about the tsunami. They were in the warning broadcast station, and they were warning people, you know, you need to get out, the tsunami's coming. And then they said that they broadcast somebody yelling, run, and that was the last thing that they heard from them, and everybody who'd been warned about it through this broadcast system was getting out, and that station, which was situated in an emergency place so they could see these things, did not get out, and the station's now apparently under many feet of mud from the tsunami. And so those people, they're sacrificed again their lives to try to save for the greater good. And you just think of being in that situation, it's really, you know, we have a lot of heroism of people that in American history as well who rise above these challenges and give them their own selves to save other people. And we had talked last week about how that's very much an instinct when you're a parent, which would make sense with Tamsin Donner. I think that in this case, you know, it's the whole community too. And that's something that, Mom, you touch on in the book, of all these people pulling together to try to have the group survive. And so on one hand, you're having an individualist spirit of each person's trying to save their families, and on the other, of everybody trying to make it out. And I think that's something we can really think about now, today, you know, on the other side of the world.
Well, at a certain point, it did break down to every family for itself, and because the resources were so slim. But
Tamsin was, you know, having those other people who were not related to her that she was watching out for, Jean-Baptiste and, Wolfinger.
Yeah,
Mrs. Wolfinger.
And
she was looking out for them.
it certainly certainly Peggy Breen gave a bit of meat to the little Reed girl when she was dying, and those were huge decisions because you had so little food, and you would, you know, charity begins at home. You justice begins next door. You save, if you have your family there and only enough food for your family, to give a little bit to some other starving child is a huge decision. But back to how people behave and in Japan and all, it's just none of us know what we would do until we're in a situation like that. You like to think, oh, I would be this way or I would be that way, but you really just don't know until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, as you were saying, those people working at the factory, and then there's also Doctors Without Borders that sent in two teams of people to go trying to hit the hardest areas, and you think about those people, and they're going right into the thick of it, or the military. I read that our Navy had been exposed to radiation, and they were trying to figure out how to handle that, and, you know, you just think this is a situation where people do rise above their own self-interest to figure
out. It's like 9/11 with the first responders and the firefighters racing in there, and it's, as you say, I mean, we're sending a lot of nuclear experts over to try to help them, but they, of course, are exposing themselves to tremendous risk, too, and those are truly altruistic acts. The rescuers who came in with the Donner Party, those stories are all magnificent stories of heroism where these rescue parties just almost kept perishing themselves because the elements were so strong and the difficulty so great.
I think about it when you said the rescue party that came in and the people from the Donner Party went out and ate their shoelaces of their snowshoes at night.
Uh-huh.
And the sneaking out there, and it definitely reflects that desperation, so much so that they're eating their way out. You know, they're eating their rescue ticket there, that they're not going to have those snowshoes that they can walk on the snow. And
well, it was the shoelaces.
I know, but I'm saying that the laces from it is still part of that equipment, and that just shows also that incredible balance of what situation they were in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, they probably made some substitute, so their shoes.
Yeah. Well, we know some people in Japan, Tyson, and mm-hmm. yesterday we were able to call one friend of ours, and it was one of those situations where we were hemming and hawing about, do we call, or is that sort of more of an imposition on people over there? And I think it really did mean something to them. We got an email from them this morning saying it was really a nice thing. But they did report that they're going 3 hours a day without electricity in the country, and because there isn't enough power to that can be generated. And so people are going three-hour, I guess you call it brownouts. And he said, so that's really not that much of a sacrifice, and they're trying to figure out, you know, what else is going to be happening that will impact all of their lives. And they're only mm-hmm. 2 hours away from the nuclear reactors. So
sure.
It's a country that's very closely, you know, connected geographically to all of that stuff. And yet he's someone who lived through World War II and not having any food then and having the Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so I think it's interesting to hear the perspective of life being long, and he said you see many interesting things when you live long enough. It made us all reflect on how, again, you know, one's own luck and thinking about
sure.
the way other people are living now.
And I mean, I spent a lot of time in Japan, and what I thought was very interesting is that, you know, I paid attention to crime rates and social interaction, and there really wasn't a whole lot of crime. And even people that maybe over here would be very rude or not get along in a social setting, people in Japan would be a lot more polite with their enemies or people that they didn't get along with in dealing with particular classes or whatnot. So, you know, I look at a devastation like this as being even more of an insult to the social landscape.
Well, I actually, this is Gabrielle, obviously, the younger one, and I did study about this during college, and I lived in Japan a bit, so I've, in fact, wrote a whole paper on that exact issue, Tyson, so it's sort of funny you brought it up. There, it's
and I didn't know that. I had no clue I wasn't setting you up for anything.
It's very complicated, that whole issue, because there's a big difference between the way the Japanese learn culturally, their sense of shame versus guilt. And so in traditional Western cultures, there's a sense of guilt that is internalized early on. So the idea of sin or of doing something wrong, a sense of morality from there, and that's very much we push to internalize those feelings. And in Japan, there's a very collective idea of guilt, which is on the lines of shame, and so you are ashamed in front of other people. That doesn't always apply then when they remove themselves from that cultural situation. So sometimes Japanese, during wartime, have done horrific atrocities, and it's because they're outside of that norm. So that all is extremely complicated. I don't want to talk about it in platitudes and stuff. But
it's like Spring Breakers, right?
Yes, exactly. And so I think that one of the interesting things, though, that this does show in this horrible tragedy is they said even though people are very panicked, you can tell inside, they are still lining up politely. They're allowing people to have their turn to get out of the cities or to get medical care. They're not pushing their own needs in front of others. And that's something that would be potentially different, you know, in another culture, that they're there, they're working together and still having that sense of decorum, which is very interesting, and politeness. Even under such disastrous, horrific circumstances that, you know, would push anybody to the edge.
And then what about
you're
the
not valuing yourself. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. You're not valuing
yourself. I was just going to say, you're not valuing yourself above the community. You are one of the community. It's the community that's important.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a huge part of Impatient with Desire, is, you know, and we've talked about this before. The idea of community in the mid 1800s, as opposed to today, you know, back then you were more forced to be face to face with your community than you are now.
That was something that someone on the online book club was talking about that I thought was interesting. Let me try to find it here. It was Tina. Tina. Okay,
yeah.
If you're listening, call in, Tina, because we'd like to hear from you about it. But I'll just quote what you wrote. You said, I think in times of crisis, people do tend to come together to fight for survival, but it takes a while for that instinct to come in. The difference between now and then, well, the pioneers lived by a sense of community, and now we hardly know who our neighbors are until something bad happens. I know this is not the case with all of us, but I remember the last quake I was in, and it was amazing how little I knew about my own neighbors. I think there is a sense of community. We're more willing to struggle it out a bit to survive, the power of numbers. And then she says, basically, with that comes confidence. That's exactly what you're saying, Tyson. It's true.
Yeah, I was thinking about the times in my past. They weren't disasters or tragedies, but times like the 08 election, where I stood in line with people voting that I had never seen them before, but apparently they lived a block from me. And since then, we don't communicate, but we see each other around the neighborhood. And it's like sometimes you need that. It doesn't have to be a negative thing like an earthquake or a tsunami.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the world shaking society up a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I had that same experience where my husband and I worked at the polls, and we never had done that before, and we thought, well, that's a good thing to do, and we worked at the polls, and we ended up meeting all of our neighbors that we had not yet, we hadn't met them. And you wonder, too, about now with where people are glued to their iPhones and their BlackBerries, even though they're in the midst of people, if
mm-hmm.
that sense of apartness is going to just grow.
I think it is, except I think people are glued to their iPhones because they're craving community. So my husband has said that he's a professor, and he says it's sort of ironic how the students will leave class and immediately get on their cell phones, and no longer do they talk to each other as they're walking down the street or out of class. They don't even get to know the people in their own class. They just immediately get on their phones or texting somebody, and yet they're reaching out, trying to desperately create that sense of connection with people while missing it all around them. And that's kind of an interesting irony.
Well, hopefully all this technological community will come back full circle in ways and reinforce both kinds of community. That's my belief. That's what I think is going to happen.
Well, there's obviously a great richness in Twitter's saving a lot of people's lives in Japan right now. So there's an extraordinary richness to technology. And hey, we're doing this book club on technology.
Yeah.
So you can't not.
And what would where would the Donner Party be with Twitter? I mean,
exactly.
If they were tweeting.
Even in this case, I'd just say I have read a lot of novels, and I think it's really cool, Mom, that you're doing this, where you're reaching out to people technologically, and you do the Goodreads book club, and you're interacting with people on their blogs, and I think that's something that didn't exist with your other books, and
no,
I think it's an extraordinary opportunity for people to connect with you as a writer and ask you questions.
Yeah, and that goes the other way, too. It's an extraordinary opportunity for me to connect with a reader, and you had that before, maybe at a bookstore reading or someone writing you a letter, but not the same as on the internet. It's such an entirely different ball game, and it's just going to be more and more and more of that, because we know like 1/4 of an inch of the possibilities of the internet. It just continues to dramatically change our lives. And with the technology, it's also why we know what's happening in Japan, that we can practically watch things in real time. It's amazing. I was watching on Al Jazeera the Egyptians and now the Libyans, and how you're watching that almost in real time, where in times gone by, a lot of time would pass before you would know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting, too, because I'm here in Ohio, and there's obviously a lot of political unrest about the collective bargaining against firefighters and teachers and things. And I think that's interesting because I think a lot of people here have taken hope from seeing it in that real-time technology from Egypt and then from Wisconsin. And now you see the first responders in Japan who are rushing over there. And I think that's also, again, kind of strengthening people's resolve that we should value these jobs and value these people who work in them. And again, that wouldn't have been happening as much if it weren't for this technology that connects all these communities with similar values.
Yeah. And also, like Tyson, you're talking about that you lived in Japan, and Gabrielle, you lived in Japan, and I visited Japan, and part of the huge changes of where people now can travel and things are so much more global is that we called that man last night because we feel connected to him. Even though it's happening thousands of miles away, we feel connected and we want to help in some way. And what can we do? And that's a good part of the increased communication.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, it's also interesting how, if you think of the letters that are in the nonfiction book Searching for Tamsin Donner, and then you incorporate a bunch of that into the novel, that that was the form of technology, and it would take so long for that to get to the intended recipient, if it ever did. And now we have just such a completely revolutionized way of communicating. It's kind of mind-blowing to think about the difference of what it was like for people then.
Yeah. Well, you don't save your emails and reread them the way people used to do letters. You know, that's in one way. That's a loss of it. But the other part is the quick communication. Mm-hmm. So there's gains and losses on all of these things, but they are what we have. So we have to, you know, we have to do it.
Well, but when are we going to reach the time? Maybe this is already happening. You know, there are books that are coming out that are emails. I mean, they're a collection of emails, and you know, when am I going to see a lot of emails printed out for sale on eBay? You know, I mean, it sounds
maybe
crazy,
if it's from Hillary Clinton or something about foreign policy. I don't know.
Or something related to an historical period.
Yeah. Well,
I don't
WikiLeaks,
know, Jason.
Right? WikiLeaks.
You're not going to see it from me because I can hardly get through my email.
Well, now a lot of companies are automatically having emails deleted after a couple of years. Did you know that?
Oh.
And I was sort of amazed to hear that, but they're just completely purged, and they said it's just an issue of storage. They can't keep it. And yet it raises an issue for workers in that they want to go back and look at what contract did we have with this company 5 years ago, and it's not there.
Wow.
And time can fly by really quickly.
Yeah.
Well, we could spend the whole week, I think, talking about what's going on in Japan. And I have a lot of questions for an author on this. Questions like, what is going to be the literature that comes out of this new wave of disasters, because every one of them that's happened in the last 10 years, 12 years, has had a heavy impact on the literary world, I think. Sometimes it takes a little bit, but but what about, you know, last week we were talking about parenting and children being forced to adopt the political viewpoints of their parents. And I was reading about the children in Japan that, you know, they're really looking at the world from this new political perspective that in a lot of ways they hadn't before. But do you want to talk a little bit about parenting and political viewpoints with kids and related to the
book? We had a caller, Meg, who just had a really thoughtful question, and she was talking about, as a parent herself, she was so struck when thinking about the Donner Party that there were 81 people trapped, and 41 of them were children 14 and under, and the notion that the children would suffer, that the parents' decision cost the children. And you're talking about, you know, politically, I think everything, that all the choices we make are affecting our children, and we actually teach those choices to our children because they're our values. And then the children, I know when I got in the women's movement in the late 60s, and I taught my children, you know, as they came along, and they had to, at school, go and defend those things. And I remember, I mean, there were teachers that would sort of take them on, and they were little kids, and one teacher said, I help with the dishes, you know, and it was like she was a third grader, and this big man is defending himself against, because all she had said was, he said something like, we're going to build a house for some geography project, and the boys will build the house and the girls will decorate it. And she said, well, maybe, you know, I could help build too. And then it went into a whole discussion. But I'm just saying that little children, this happens, you know, what school you're going to send your children to, what neighborhood you're going to live in. All of these decisions that reflect your values, your children have the riches of them and they have the costs of them. And I don't see any way out of it, frankly. You know, I mean, you're not going to, you want your children, you want to train your children and teach your children what you believe, but none of these things are ever without cost.
I will say, yeah, on the recipient side of that, that I think that that's very true. I think also, though, I would say about you, Mom, that you were pretty aware a lot of the time of these choices, and you would discuss them with us. We had a lot of conversations that are around. We had a round table with the Lazy Susan in the middle, and you know, we'd go around and, for instance, see a movie, and then after we'd come home and we would go around round robin and talk about what your opinion was of the movie at, you know, any age. This started at, you know, 5. And so you were expected to kind of come up with your own opinion. And I think that's the way to teach those values. I know that as far as feminism and sexism in school, I definitely developed in one class a way that when the teacher would say something sexist and then say to me, Gabrielle, aren't you going to say something? I would act like I hadn't heard him. And you know, it was sort of better to act dumb and clueless than to feel like I had to take him on every week, you know, with defending the flag for both genders, why they should be equal.
Yeah.
On the flip side, when a teacher, you know, the calculus teacher who tells a rape joke to open up his class every year, you know, and that one of my sisters finally stood up and said, that's just inappropriate. I think that's a moment that builds character. And it's not that we as children were fighting a battle for you or suffering from choices you made. It was allowing us to decide what mattered to us. And I see that with the Donner children, that they, you know, made their choices in their lives following that based on the parenting choices their parents showed them of caring about them, of wanting them to survive, of sticking together as a family. And how, I didn't know the story of how much the children suffered until just in the last couple of years, because you never told us that part, Mom. But that's incredible to me, that they suffered really terribly for many years after, and were, their stuff was stolen from them, and they were tricked by people, and they were separated and married off as child brides, and yet they had the sense that they all had to be together, and it took them how long? 30 years?
15 years.
15 years till they worked to get back together again under one roof, and that drove them, their sense of family and of togetherness. And I think that's what their parents' choices gave them. It gave them, yes, suffering, but it also gave them this real strength and family and a value that did not quit. It's my little soapbox moment.
Well, the Donners and the other people certainly felt that going to California would be advantageous for them and for their children, and that's why they went. And they knew it would be a difficult trip, but no one thought that it was going to be, you know, a disastrous trip. And, you know, I think that's what we teach our children, things that we believe will be advantageous for them to know and the kind of people to be. I was just saying, there are always costs to that. There's costs to everything, you know.
Yeah.
If you didn't, you know, that's, you're not doing your children any service either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what's the flip side? Is the flip side having your own political or social beliefs and then intentionally not bringing your kids into it, and so they don't know a big part of who you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, too. You know, even in the taking of risk nationally, the idea of nuclear power, there have been all these people talking about it, and should we continue with plans to pursue more nuclear plants here or not? And there was an expert on NPR, I think it was yesterday, who was saying, well, it's such an extreme circumstance, you know, that this happened, and reactors are built for the areas that they're in to be safe. And the NPR correspondent said, well, now this reactor was built to be safe in that area, and yet this is it was 10 times more than they ever expected an earthquake would ever hit the Fukuyama district. Mm-hmm. And so the scientist was saying, well, yes, you know, these extreme occurrences can happen, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to just basically go by the numbers. And it was really interesting because I felt, what are you talking about? You know, you want to plan for the extremes. You want to think, just as the Donners did, though they didn't have all the information. That was their downfall. But if they were planning, you know, bringing way more food than they ever thought would be necessary and much more with them than they thought they'd ever need to use to repair things or to build things once they got to California.
Yeah.
And so they were planning for the extremes, and it was a lot of it was misinformation that they got that led to their tragedy. But in this case, here we have the wherewithal to plan for the extremes, and are we going to do it? Or are we going to sort of say, well, statistically, it probably won't happen again.
Well, there's that weird thing in human nature. Everybody always thinks, well, it won't happen to me. You know, and how many people are sitting out in California without earthquake kits, you know? It's not going to happen to me, although, of course, it's going to happen. It's just, it may not happen this week or next year, but there's a 95% chance it's going to happen within a certain number of years. And so why do people go for the 5% and say, well, it's not going to happen to me? You know, that's just the way people are.
Or even the 95%. I mean, that's what's interesting to me on this idea of national strategy for energy planning. That just really made me think about it yesterday of, you know, shouldn't we be planning for the 100%?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I don't have a disaster kit ready, but I know that's on my to-do list. And yet, on a major scale, I mean, you know, if I don't have it and something happens to me and, you know, that's one person, but on doing huge policy, it's also interesting to think, well, how are these choices being made by these sort of people we put in parental figures for us, and should we be a little more involved or, you know, trusting of those decisions, and that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I remember we used to live in Buffalo, New York, and there was an area, Love Canal, that had a lot of radiation and was very dangerous, and eventually got all emptied out when one brave woman, Lois Gibbs, just insisted that she just politically made people look at it. But for a long time, people would say, it has to be safe. They wouldn't let us live here if it wasn't safe. And that's so crazy, you know. It's people do have to take a certain amount of responsibility themselves and not just think that our leaders are always going to protect us or know the right thing. That's, you know, that's why we need an informed citizenry. So
it may even be from ignorance, too, you know, that people think it's fine and then turns out later it isn't fine.
Yeah.
That's where it, you know, you're right. We do have to inform ourselves, too. Yeah. This is kind of getting sad. Something you said, Tyson, about both sort of technology and the unknown, I was thinking about that being in Ohio, and this sort of leads, you know, connects to what we were just saying, but the idea of a frontier, and that this was the frontier then, the kicking off point, and the place to start adventure, and I think of it now, and it's such a it's considered sort of the stodgy place to live in America is the Midwest, and it's very traditional, and, you know, at the time it was the great, unknown, wild place to start your adventure, and it's really interesting to think about how much just our horizons have changed.
Absolutely. Well, and the way the geographical landscape changes, I mean, the way you describe it, it's like the Paris of the United States. The Baghdad of the old frontier. You're right.
Only 150 years ago. It's incredible.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Or even the way things kind of change now, or the way cities grow, the way in Southern California, there isn't a distinction between San Diego, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, Palm Springs, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then how long is it going to be before San Francisco and Las Vegas and Phoenix are all joined together? And then what is the frontier, you know?
Yeah,
didn't
I
really
wonder if
happen.
There is, if people feel there is any frontier.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
But that kind of growth didn't happen the same way in Ohio from those days.
Mm-hmm. I think people think the internet is a frontier. I'm not
I was
sure
just thinking that, yeah, that maybe
sure
the intellectual
geographically,
land is the
geographically, I don't know if we have any more frontiers, but...
Do you think there are going to be... well, let's look at your book. It is a fictionalization of a lost journal, of an historical figure. You know, are we going to get to the point with all of this internet stuff that there... is a similar book about an avatar?
I don't know.
There have been those, haven't they?
A person that doesn't really exist, or what was the movie? Was it? Oh, you're gonna have to help me out here. Where
the main character was an avatar?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, that happens a lot. But it's was it Tron that they had the actor who was in the original. And the one today was they kind of morphed them together,
right? Well, Jeff Bridges, they had, I think they did some CGI to make him look like he, you know, was 30 years ago or something, or I don't know, 20 years ago, whatever it is. Sorry, Jeff Bridges. And I think that they were having him as the avatar playing against himself as the real person too.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So,
I'm sorry.
You know.
Sorry for the tangent there, but.
No, I mean.
You guys are before my time. That's all I can say.
But, yeah, I think that there a lot of people think about those. But that's a kind of a realm of science fiction in a way, isn't it?
It is now, but, you know, maybe it won't be. It won't be science fiction in the future.
Well, it may be that the internet will be so filled up with so much information that it will become the frontier, because you're going to have to figure out how to navigate through it all.
Yeah.
Well,
to
bring it back to books a bit, there's kind of a ruckus happening now with libraries and publishers because HarperCollins has just said that with the e-books in the library that they're going to have to expire in a year, because right now people can download them from home and it can go on in perpetuity. Mm. And so the publishers just feel that this is something that's going to further drive a nail in their coffin. And the libraries too, because people don't have to go into the libraries. They can do it at home. It's really raises a lot of very interesting issues that people are going to have to resolve or compromise on in some way. But, you know, we never had these kind of things to think about before, and now we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
What? I mean, be devil's advocate against publishing companies, which I'm not, of course. Let me just reiterate, I'm not against publishing companies succeeding and figuring all this out. But, you know, what's the difference with a library buying a physical book for $15, $25 and buying the digital version and then only being able to use it 26 times or whatever it is?
Well, the books wear out, so the libraries have to replace them, or one hopes that they will replace them. I'm not sure even that happens now. But so that's one thing. There would not be that profit coming in for the publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the libraries sell old books, raise money for themselves on that, and that would be gone. And, I don't know. Mostly I think the worst thing is people not going into libraries, because
mm-hmm.
I think a library is a wonderful sanctuary and place to go. But
you don't think maybe I'm just an optimist here, but you don't think that kids having the access to, maybe there's an app for Central Library downtown Los Angeles that kids use, and it's on their mind more, so they are going to think about going into the library more eventually.
I think
I don't know.
The thing about libraries is it leads you to other things that are unexpected, and that's the thing that I think is lost when manuscripts become virtual, because you are going to find your book that you might have looked up online about, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls or something, and or hieroglyphics in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And as you're going there, suddenly you find out Native American music is a book there that looks interesting, or,
yeah,
you know, Mid-Eastern yeah. studies, and suddenly mm-hmm. you're off to a whole other adventure. And I think that's something that here in Ohio, we have this, the Columbus Library System, I think, is the number one rated library system in the country, and they're constantly expanding their collection. And that's because there's a lot of money put into it. And even so, there's an incredible pressure to cut funding to it, to deal with storage issues. So they're constantly having to get rid of books, and those decisions are extremely difficult. I know that Ohio State University is facing that as well, and they just built a new library that's exquisitely beautiful and very inviting for people, because they felt it was important to create a space that would be on par with the stadium, with the sports stadium, to mm-hmm. have people want to visit it. And yet, in doing so, they had to get rid of, I believe it was at least a third of the books. Mm-hmm. And there was someone I met on an airplane whose job was just to go around the country burning books from places like this that are just getting rid of them. And cool. 'cause they don't know what to do with them. And that's a kind of horrific thought, because you think about the Donner Party. If these things were not existent, how would we know these materials? How would we know what's true? And I think that's where it gets really tricky, is thinking about scholarship in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. along with that, too, physically, a library is an institution that is both communal and individual. And that's a wonderful thing about a library. You can go in and you can just find what you particularly want, but there are other people around you. There are people to help you. You're not just this isolated person trying to surf the Internet and find it.
That brings us full circle back to what we were talking in the
yeah.
beginning.
Yeah.
Communal versus individual.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. Well, I don't want to get too deep in here and run out of time before you read a little bit from the book. If for anything else, but as a celebration of our publication date.
Okay. Well, I thought I would read, several people have asked, it keeps coming up about the difference between writing in fiction and nonfiction, and my book last year, Searching for Tamsin Donner, is a memoir, nonfiction, and it's all about Tamsin Donner and our family's search for her, and it has her letters in it. But then that's the facts, and then when the facts run out, you have to turn to the imagination. And so I thought I'd read just a little bit. She was married twice, and it's interesting where her first husband, Tully Dozier, she says about him in a letter to her sister, I do not intend to boast of my husband. She underlines boast. I do not intend to boast of my husband, but I find him one of the best of men, affectionate, industrious, and possessed of an upright heart. These are requisite to make life pass on smoothly. And that's in 1831, and she loses her family, her husband, a son, a daughter, in a three-month period. And she is by herself for quite a long time. And in 1839, she's emigrated to Illinois, 1838, and she meets George Donner. And so she says about George Donner, telling her sister about him, she says, I find my husband a kind friend who does all in his power to promote my happiness. I have as fair a prospect for a pleasant old age as anyone. Now, in the novel, she tells about when she decides to marry George Donner. Our courtship was brief, and more was not needed. It still surprises me that I, who had never planned to marry, married twice, and to two Southerners, both from North Carolina, both steady and measured, with honey voices and quick laughs. I have no doubt that my two husbands would have liked each other. Sometimes I think George is exactly the kind of man Tully would have grown into had he lived. I never expected nor tried to find another man after Tully, But the afternoon I watched George build the stone wall where his farm faced the road, I knew I would marry him. He spread a tarp on the ground, a quilt over that near an apple tree, and we ate fresh apples and talked easily. I'm very fond of stone fences, Mr. Donner, I said. They're unusual in this part of the country. My father's fond of them, too, he said. When I was a boy, he talked often about them. He was a militiaman in New Hampshire, and they saved his life more than once. He laughed. Anyone can build a stone fence in the East. It's much more of a challenge here. This pile of stones of all sizes lay next to a cart filled with more stones. Some he had wrested from a fallow field, others left over from the new state house in Springfield. He went regularly to Springfield to hear the members of the legislature speak and ask if I would like to accompany him sometime. After mentioning with amusement that one well-known member was a charlatan and a windbag, he wasn't sure which was worse, he became engrossed in the work. I must admit, I quickly stopped correcting my papers and became engrossed in watching him. He looked carefully at the partially finished wall, looked at the stones that ranged from perhaps 5 pounds to 50, then back at the wall before selecting a stone from the pile. He lifted the huge boulders easily, and I have always admired physical strength manifested with grace in a man. Yet he chose the smaller stones with a craftsman's care, testing the heft of the stone in his hands, feeling its planes and grooves before choosing the place on the wall he wanted it to be, several times trying one, two, or three places before being satisfied. He checked both sides of the wall for precision. Each stone should cast a shadow, he said. He didn't build the wall in order. In some places it was a foot high, 2 feet in others. The stones determined its order. It's really an art, Mr. Donner, I said. It's pretty simple, Mrs. Dozier, he said. 1/2, 2/1. He was in no hurry nor rush. I would come to understand that he cared more about the building than the completion. And my heart said, I will cast my lot with this calm, deliberative man who cares about the fit and rightness of things. A month later, when he asked, Mrs. Dozier, could you ever see your way into a future with me? I answered readily, I am already there, Mr. Donner.
Nice. That connects to what my Telly is called in. Telly, I think, on that first show, and asked how you came up with sort of the historical research in the voice. That's nice comparison to illustrate that.
Well, you know, George is often described in some of the Donner Party books, mostly the older ones, as kind of a bit of a bumbler. He was a very affable man, and people in the town of Springfield, the young people all called him Uncle George. And I just never agreed that he, you know, with that assessment of him. He had emigrated many times, and each time he was successful. He had 3 farms in Springfield when they left, and he married 3 times. 2 of his wives died. He had 11 children. He had a great deal of life experience. So I wanted to look at that, the other side of when people talk about slow or plodding, really a carefulness and a steadiness. And so that's why I chose the wall to write about that.
Well, I think that's a really, I almost think that we should have started the show off with that, because that just brings up so much great discussion to mind. But we are running out of time.
We'll have to do it on Goodreads and other
things. Yeah, we're going to have to continue the discussion on Goodreads.com. If you're not already a part of the Impatient with Desire online book club, which is now a public online book club, you don't have to be part of the special club anymore. Just go to Goodreads.com and search Impatient with Desire, and you'll find us on there, and you can just join in. If you have any questions, you can, of course, call 213-623-1773 or email us at info@rarebirdlit.com, and we'll get you set up right away. And, of course, we're going to be doing a number of book club broadcasts in the future. Be sure to go to the site and check there for some updates. Anything else you two want to say? Join us on Facebook.
The Impatient with Desire book group.
And above all, the book is available in paperback now. Tell all your friends to go buy it.
Tell your library.
Tell your library to pick it up.
Your library. Request it at your library and then go in. Support your library and your independent bookstores.
And if they're reluctant, just say, hey, this is a Western Heritage Award winner for Outstanding Western Novel. It's not just any other book. It's a fantastic title with lots of wonderful accolades. I don't think this is going to be the last of the great reviews of Impatient with Desire. This is just the beginning. So on that note, unless you guys have anything else to say, we'll conclude our publication day broadcast.
Well, I just want to say thank you, Dyson, and everybody who's listening, and I love to hear from the readers.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's tons more to say. I think what we're most interested in is having people write into Goodreads or on the Facebook page or email Tyson. We'll keep up the discussion, and it's a great way to connect to, as Mom said, for her to connect to readers and for readers to connect to an author. So thanks for facilitating this, Tyson.
And to each other, too.
Yes.
That's right. Well, thank you, both of you. I've had a blast discussing all these great points with you, and I look forward to the next broadcast and communicating online. So thanks to everybody else. Have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You on a debris at the Sunday morning market. You were starting to the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. You knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. At the depot, with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working.